T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Listen to every MLB game live.
In the deep left center field, it is high, it is far, it is gone.
Stream minor league affiliates.
The Midwest League home run leader.
And watch the best baseball highlights and look-ins on MLB Big Inning. MLB At Bat is your all-in-one live baseball subscription for only $3.99 per month.
Deep left field, it's gonna go! Alvarez ties the game!
Subscribe to At Bat within the MLB app today. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Corner of Broadway and Battery. Damon Bruce, Ray Ratto, and Matt Kolsky. Broadcasting in beautiful downtown San Francisco. This is Damon, Ratto, and Kolsky on 95.7 The Game.
Jordan Clarkson almost put the old banana in the tailpipe last night. He really did. But the Warriors, they end up winning a game against Utah, and I don't care who was or wasn't playing last night. That was a by-the-skin-of-your-teeth win for the Warriors in a game that, when they're decided by skins of teeth, they don't usually go the Warriors' way. It was nice to see them get something that is a hold-on-to-victory victory under their belt. Feels like they haven't had one of those in a long time. And for the first time this year, Ray, we can actually guarantee the audience something about the Golden State Warriors. And it's not how they're going to play tonight against Phoenix. It's not how they're going to close out the regular season. But we can guarantee everybody, you're going to be in the play-in tournament. They clinched that last night. At the beginning of the year, if you told me that was the X marks the spot, it would have felt like maybe we're setting ourselves up for a disappointment. Knowing what we know now, it's probably the right landing spot.
Yeah, they're going to end up pretty much where most people thought they'd end up, in that somewhere in that 7-10. There were a few people on the outside who thought, oh, no, they could be awful. But they were so in the minority that they didn't matter, even back then. And the Warriors have managed, though God only knows how, to end up about where they're going to be. And last night was huge, if for no other reason than Memphis essentially eliminated any thoughts New Orleans had of staying in this. So New Orleans, Memphis is still right on their tail if they want to, you know, avoid being the 9-10. And that's where you have to, I mean, if you're a fan, that's where you focus your vision now, is making sure that Memphis doesn't pass you.
One of the things that we agreed upon yesterday is that a lot of people probably couldn't explain what the play-in tournament looked like. And networks have done a terrible job explaining how it's supposed to work. We haven't done a good enough job explaining how it's supposed to work. So we will explain to you again today how it all works. And the Warriors, they're in position now, depending on what the Lakers do in the next couple games, Ray, to where they could actually be hosting that game. And given the way the Warriors have shot against the Lakers down at Staples Center, specifically Steph Curry, I don't know if that's a bad idea, man. If you got to take them on, I do know that looking at the Lakers is no easy task. I don't care how much the Warriors have got things going or cooking. I look back at a recap of the 3 games they played against the Lakers. It is overwhelming Los Angeles in terms of what has happened in that series. The Warriors won the game that everyone remembers the most because you take brutal, vicious, not even competing poundings and you sort of throw those out. The Lakers have pounded the Golden State Warriors but for a singular quarter this year. So there is no easy matchup. There is no good time, I think, to be catching L.A. They've so thoroughly beaten the Warriors, but it could be that, and we all know that that is going to be worth the price of admission, but I don't know if it ends up good for Golden State.
That all depends on LeBron James's health.
Sure does.
I mean, because essentially the Warriors have no meaningful chance of being the 7. They're 2.5 back with 3 to go. So that's sort of been decided. But the real key here is how close to actual health the Lakers are. Because even if LeBron James plays, and he probably will because he's Johnny Headstrong when it comes to that, a high ankle sprain will tell you when it's ready, not the other way around. You don't get to will your way around that. And they're a team that's been beaten up, not just him. I mean, Anthony Davis missed a ton of time. Dennis Schroeder, who's important to them, has missed a ton of time. They're a shadow of their former selves. That said, they're still playing at home. So tell me how close to LeBron James LeBron James is, and I'll tell you how close to having no chance the Warriors have.
We will get our next look at LeBron James apparently tomorrow night in Houston. That's when he is looking at returning to the court after stepping back on the court, only to step off of it for a couple of games after he had just gotten back on the court up in Sacramento. So we're keeping an eye on all of that. Obviously, it's the time of the year where you got to keep your eye on a lot of different things in the NBA. Draymond Green is talking about whether or not he knows where the Warriors are going, how much it matters to him, what the actual path through the play-in looks like. What I think matters most to Draymond is the fact that these games matter. And he said as much last night. A question that I think less secure athletes answer a little bit more carefully. Draymond Green just told you, look, when the chips are down, I'm in. When the chips aren't down, I'm around.
I can play better when they matter. When they don't matter, it's a little tougher. I'm enjoying these games. You know, they matter, and you have to get up for them. So this is fun for me for sure. It's been a while since we played some games late in the season that really matter.
He will have opened himself up a little bit for criticism with that real response, but it's real, and I don't blame him. And looking at everything that he's been through and this team has been through, yeah, it's hard to get up for a Wednesday night against, you know, the YMCA Thunder. But you put it in a week where it matters, and look how frosty they all were. Look how frosty he's been. In the last 20 games particularly, Ray, you can feel Draymond is like a chef sharpening that knife, knowing that he's about to break down an animal. Like, it's coming.
And that's why making the playoffs mattered more than it was securing a better draft choice. Because you break faith with a guy like Draymond Green by tanking, or you break faith with a guy like Stephen Curry, you ask for the whirlwind. That's why it mattered that they got in. It's because those guys wanted it. And if you think that having a slightly better draft pick is more important than keeping them on board, then you don't get it.
So you talk about breaking the faith. And that brings us to, I guess, what is a local story that's been slowly developing for the better part of 20 years. That is pinging on a national level thanks to a column Jeff Passan shared today on ESPN that the A's are now considering relocation. And we actually have the rare public statement from John Fisher, who's quoted as saying the future success of the A's depends on a new ballpark. Oakland is a great baseball town, and we will continue to pursue our waterfront ballpark project. We will also follow MLB's direction to explore other markets. Stop me if you've heard this before, all right?
Well, I will correct you in only one way. It's not been two decades. It's been 45 years.
Fair enough.
Because the first time the A's started looking around at a new place to go, Charlie Finley still owned the team. It was 78, and they were looking at Denver. So the A's got here, and almost immediately the guy who pays the bills was looking around to go somewhere else. Fisher on his own has looked north of the Coliseum. He's looked at the community college buildings and basically declared them his even though they weren't. He's looked at Fremont. He's looked at San Jose. And now having essentially abandoned Howard Terminal because that's what he's just done.
Well, I mean, it was a bad faith starter. What he's asking for Oakland to make Howard Terminal a reality was, in my opinion, a bad faith, non-negotiable opener that he knew was going to fall completely flat on its face. That's why they way over-asked, because they knew that even under-asking was probably a non-delivery from the city of Oakland. So they over-ask and then turn around to Major League Baseball and just say, hey, we got to go. And that's it's a John Fisher deplorable way to play the system. But this is what I think he's been setting up, the slow con, the long con, whatever you want to call it, for a real long time. And in my mind, they're gone. Today is the first official step into a greener pasture. John Fisher has watched Joe Lacob move his team just about 6 miles, and it's the second most valuable team in the NBA right now. He watched the Raiders move to Vegas, which has forever to the better financially changed their arc. The grass is greener elsewhere, and John Fisher knows it, and he's too lazy to get anything done here, and he doesn't have the juice to get anything done here, and he's got no political capital here, and he's got to take his business somewhere else to have anybody do business with him.
Except for a couple of things. The first of which is the Warriors and the Raiders moved pre-COVID. No cities have money to throw around on this.
Oh, yeah. They couldn't get it done in the best of times. So good luck during the worst
of times. That's the real betrayal here, is that they decided to hit Oakland, you know, with another one of these at a time when Oakland is as defenseless financially as most cities in America. That's why, even though he's going to look around, I have a sneaking suspicion nobody's going to want it.
It's
Portland doesn't have the money or the civic or the corporate infrastructure. Charlotte has never been interested. Nashville has already told them, we've already built our new stadium. That's all our budget will handle. And Las Vegas had to bilk the state out of $850 million just to get half the money to build the football stadium. That avenue is not open to the Raiders, to the A's either. I think they're going to look around and find out that people are at best lukewarm about having them there and absolutely not interested in paying for their stadium.
It's only going to take one motivated city that's looking 20, 30 years down the road. It's going to take a person with a little bit of a vision and know-how to think that investing in Major League Baseball is a good idea to help grow our town. Somebody might be interested in the A's. I am not about to cross every city in America off the map just because it's been tough times. The opportunity to pick up a major league franchise is so rare and unique. I think bad choices can be made to find a way to do it. And I wouldn't be surprised if there was a town in America willing to make that choice. 888-957-9570. We're not going to spend much time on this because, I mean, it's nothing. It's not a news story. It's just confirmation of the suspicion that there's no good faith between that team and that city bringing you closer to a permanent home for a team that has an owner who totally sucks. We have a great show for you otherwise today. Raja Bell is stopping on by to talk a little basketball, and he's going to do that a little bit later on this hour. We got a new all-time triple-double leader. Yeah, baby. So we got an awful lot to get into today. It's great to have you aboard. Damon Ratto and Kolsky. Kolsky on paternity still this week. So it's just Ray and I here, and we're brought to you by Network Capital Funding.
Damon Ratto and Kolsky continues on 95.7 The Game.
Coming up in just a little bit, we're going to say hello to a guy who knew an awful lot about how to play defense, Raja Bell. Son's coming into town. Makes a lot of sense to say hello to him. He does a Real Ones NBA podcast now for The Ringer with Logan Murdoch, who is a longtime Bay Area media guy himself. So we're going to say hello to Raja Bell in just a little bit. Ray and I here on a Tuesday afternoon. We got the Warriors with a big back-to-back. They got the Phoenix Suns tonight. Chris Paul is having a better than I think anyone really expected him to have year. I thought he was going to improve the Suns, Ray. I didn't think for a second I was going to be looking at a two seed, maybe even flirting with a one.
He helped transform that team. He showed guys who were on sort of the precipice between self-involved and out-and-out selfish, like Devin Booker. He said, no, this is how you become a pro. And I'm not saying that Devin Booker was doomed to be that, but everybody needs a guy in the room who says, you know what, you've gotten this far. Now here's the hardest last step to take. And he did that not only with Booker, but with all those guys. They are in some ways a tougher out than Utah because they do stuff at a much higher pace than most teams are used to. And so in this basketball climate, they become really difficult to play if you're trying to run clock, if you're trying to, you know, run standard offense. They defend. They're everything the Suns have never been. And that's, you know, that's why they're two games out of winning the conference.
Fundamentally sound, interesting, not just playing 7 seconds or less basketball, but real defensive effort, real offensive know-how. We'll see what they look like tonight. Warriors last night take out a Utah team that was shorthanded, obviously, in its backcourt. That game probably wouldn't have been as close as it was, Ray, if Steph Curry would just shoot more threes along the way before he gets to the fourth quarter. I'm sticking with that point.
I'm sure you are.
I'm going.
The fact that they won the game and he only shot 13 times does not matter.
13 times from three.
Yeah, but the fact is they won the game even though he didn't have his standard Curry game, which is a much better scenario for them than if they had just ridden his coattails like they have a lot of the last month or change.
Yeah, sure. As Steve Kerr said, it's really good to see somebody other than, you know, Steph Curry actually making a play.
It's huge when we can get a number of players scoring because Steph draws so much attention. Guys are going to be open. And I thought everyone was really aggressive tonight. You know, Bay's really looking for a shot. Jordan off the bench, as you mentioned. You know, Draymond as well. So it's what we need. We can't expect Steph to carry us every night offensively.
No, can't expect it to happen, even though you pretty much can set your watch by it if you give the guy enough room to do it. But Utah really did give Steph a longer night than he normally has defensively. They have really, really good defensively sound principles on that team. They know how to switch. They got versatility. And, you know, they know Steph. Quinn Snyder, I don't want to say he's figured him out in any way, shape, or form, but the tendencies, you start to know them a little bit more. Man, speaking of just knowing each other, Draymond knows exactly where Steph is going to be at any moment on the court, and you could see it in the way that play broke down. You got Looney with the ball. He kicks it out to Draymond, top of the key. He knows Steph is not about to make a dramatic cut or run anywhere. It's going to be a 45-degree angle. Boom, I'm going here. You get me the ball here. Knocks it down. Big shot. Big shot last night. Big shot. And then, man, I thought it was pretty funny. Someone said that was a masterful tank job by the Utah Jazz last night, who might want to be picking and choosing who they might see as an 8 seed. Clarkson putting one off the top of the backboard as a final shot. Mwah. It was obviously pithy, but it made me laugh.
Again, I'm not sure why Utah would care. I think it's, you know, either way, I mean, they're going to end up playing either the 7 or the 8. You know, or the two teams that survived the play-in. So I don't know that there's any advantage of them tanking. I think what happened was they were missing two really good players. And when you miss two really good players, your performance will drop off.
Yeah.
I mean, they shot a ton of threes, missed about two-thirds of them, you know, which is, you know, below standards now, especially for them.
Right. Not that Donovan Mitchell is a model of offensive efficiency, but he is probably
scoring. He's a guy who has to be guarded.
Yes, exactly. And Mike Conley, he knows how to run an offense.
Yeah.
Pure and simple.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, they were playing the Utah Jazz.
Well, luckily they didn't get their ass kicked. Thank you very much.
No, it's a really good win for the Warriors, you know, because even if they lose tonight, you know, they're still, you know, positioned well enough that they don't have to worry that much about anything other than their own performance over the last two games.
It's a money in the bank win that helps them lock a spot into the play-in tournament. So it takes a little pressure off the rest of the regular season for sure. But it's a little bit of a false positive. You got to grade that on the curve a little bit because that was not the Utah Jazz.
They're going to have a tougher time tonight, I would suggest, because I think Phoenix wants very much to win that game.
Right, and it's a back-to-back. So
yeah,
we got. You know what, Nash? I'm going to try and bring this up myself, old fashioned here. Let me go ahead and press the button myself. Shaman, Calling from Oakland. You're on 95.7 The Game. Hello.
Shaman,
what's going on?
How you doing?
Doing well, man.
Good. Just talking about the whole Oakland thing. I know you don't want to be too gone about this and stuff like that. It's just that it's just crazy how this city have produced so much talent, from MC Hammer to Mr. Fab to Marshawn Lynch, and just an array of talent up here, but we can't keep a team here. And it's just ridiculous to me, like, especially if you got like a mayor like Libby, like, and all these owners and stuff like that owning the franchise of the A's. Like, where's the rich history going now? It's like, now we're looking like a cesspool of Cleveland. And that's the route I never wanted to be, but now it's just like, Oakland is, what are we now? Like, everything is being taken from us, from Malibu. I don't know how, if y'all even lived in Oakland, but there was a little thing called Malibu for the arcades and stuff like that back in the day. And now the Raiders is gone. Now all of a sudden they talk about the A's about to be leaving. It's just, it ain't nothing for these kids to go to. There's no other place for these kids to go and having a good time. Everything is being ripped from us. So that's why all the violence is happening. Sometimes
look, it really hurts. I think that cities are held together by, there's a lot that holds a city together, and it can't just be sports, obviously. We're not that naive, but sports are really the last public gathering place. They really are. They're the place where all the classes come together and mix together and learn about each other and share in a common goal. Our hometown, we're going to root for it to cross the finish line first. There is a beautiful element of civic pride and bonding that happens when you have a team that people really care about. And these teams are cared about. Unfortunately, the poor caretaker is the owner in the A's case. And that is just something that is brutal. And you know, text line saying, Damon, why do you hate the A's? I don't hate the A's. I think A's fans are awesome. I think the team is always interesting. But they don't do anything to garner a lot of local interest, bring in fans, and they're looking to relocate because it's just not working. And you could say, you point your fingers on who to blame. I see John Fisher as the guy to blame. I look at the A's as a spectacular natural resource that has been completely squandered by this owner who sucks. He's just terrible at it. He doesn't know how to reach consensus. He doesn't know how to build political allies. There's nothing genuine about him. And there was really nothing ever genuine in the Rooted in Oakland campaign, and that comes to light today.
No, the reason why they haven't been able to get any traction is because they never tried to get traction, because throughout Fisher's tenure, they've tried to go to Fremont, tried to go to San Jose twice. They tried to annex a junior college. Now they tried to, you know, move to the waterfront, and then laid out a $12 billion bill, of which they're expecting the city to pay more than $2.5 billion of that, knowing full well that cities don't have that level of money. They just as a fact, especially in, you know, coming off of a pandemic that's not even over yet. I mean, there's a level of opportunism that we shamefully tolerate, and then there's just sort of extortion. This goes past extortion. Because it's basically the A's saying, you won't meet our price, knowing full well that what we're asking for is about six times what the Raiders asked for.
Right.
And they didn't have the money for that either. You know, and you know, the fact that it's happening now probably puts to the lie the notion that they're still going to look into Howard Terminal. Because if they're looking outside, they're not going to expend any energy inside.
Exactly. It's everything. This story by Jeff Passan today just puts a spotlight on the cavalcade. No
pun intended.
No pun intended. Poor Dave Cavill. Dave Cavill, I'm sure, has been telling everyone as much truth as he was able to share. But the truth is, Dave Cavill's been lied to by an owner who never, ever, ever cared about the fans in Oakland or saving Oakland or preserving Oakland or getting it right. Look at it this way. How are you going to get a stadium at Howard Terminal if you can't even have Marcus Semien? I mean, just straight up, if Marcus Semien is too pricey for you, how are you going to build a stadium?
I mean, that's true, but it's sort of, you know, to let Cavill off the hook bothers me because he's worked with Fisher on a number of projects. He knows what this is about, and he's been doing the dance too.
Sure.
So, yeah, he doesn't get to skate on this. He doesn't get to be the guy who said, gee, I really wanted it to work in Oakland, but
no, he was hired to be the window dressing.
Yeah,
he was, until they pulled the rug out from underneath you.
Yeah, he was the pretty shoe on the burlap dress. That's all that was.
No doubt.
So, yeah, he doesn't get to skate on this either.
But here's the thing. The difference between him and the slack that I'll cut him is I do believe that Dave Cavill has always approached A's fans with a level of respect that very few other people in that organization have ever shown A's fans. I think that guy did as much as he could to make it as comfortable as possible to be an A's fan while the entire experience is set up to be uncomfortable by the real decision maker above him.
Maybe. I mean, I'm not sure that isn't at least a little naive because as long as they're here, they have to fake it. But what were the great infrastructure expenditures that they had? The treehouse?
Oh, no, he never had any money to spend.
The point is, you know, if you're going to tart that up and then say we're rooted in Oakland just because you built a treehouse.
Yeah.
No, it is. There's a level of disingenuousness
here. Of course there has been.
All that said, I'm still not convinced they have the wherewithal to leave unless Fisher sells.
Well, it's something that we'll continue to keep an eye on as we have been for, as Ray said earlier, the better part of 40 years around here. Yeah, it's a story today, but it's kind of been a story every day.
It's not new. Decades. It's just news.
There you go. That's a good way to say it. Rajah Bell knows an awful lot about slapping the floor and playing defense. And if the Warriors are going to be anything come play-in tournament time, they're going to have to do that and stay hot Steph Curry. To talk about the Suns in town, we're very happy to say hello to Rajah Bell. Joining us here, Damon Bruce and Ray Ratto. Rajah, thank you for joining us today. I know you're doing that Real Ones NBA podcast for The Ringer with Logan Murdoch, who obviously spends a lot of time right here in the Bay Area backyard. So it's great to have you on here today. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for having me, fellas. Yeah, Logan is a proud Bay Area native, and I have to hear about it way too much for my taste. But he's a good dude, and I'm happy to be doing it. Thanks for having me on.
If this helps at all, you can backhand him. I've worked with him. You just bring across a quick right hand, he'll quiet down.
There you go. That's very nice. It's a good way to handle things, certainly in the workplace.
I'm glad I got the green light. I appreciate it.
Look at it this way. Rajah might be able to do it because this guy was nasty when he was out there playing basketball. That is for sure. We have Draymond Green, who obviously is a Swiss Army knife that is hard to compare to any other guy that really played. Now, maybe the position of center had to regress a little bit, not quite in the lands of Hakeem Olajuwon and Patrick Ewing anymore. But as the center regressed to more positionless basketball, Draymond Green, really, Rajah, it looks like he is one of those rare 1 through 5 he can defend at all guys. And it's not overhype. It's not oversell. I don't know how many guys can really say, I defend all 5 positions at an elite level. I know Rudy Gobert is good. I know he's popping out on the perimeter better than ever. I know Capella's doing the same. But Draymond is just so different.
Yeah, he is the only guy that I can think of off the top that can really guard 1 through 5. I mean, those guys will go out there, and in today's NBA, you know, they're more switches than ever. I mean, they switch 90% of the time. So they're asked to be out on the perimeter, but they don't effectively really lock down or have the capability of locking down a one. If you put him on him for, you know, 50-60% of the game, they're going to get, you know, exposed. And that's not really a knock on them. Those guys are huge. They're long. They're not, you know, used to naturally being in space. But Draymond is. And Draymond, I think, could effectively guard a one. You know, I'm not saying that he's locking any of them down like the Dame Lillards over the course of an entire night. But I think he could do an effective job on a one most of the night if you put him on him. So I would tend to agree with you. I mean, he's a very interesting player. He fills, you know, a lot of stat sheet, a lot of boxes for teams. And, you know, the beauty of a Draymond for a guy like me, it isn't necessarily what he does on the stat sheet or who he can guard. It's what he means to the to the team, to the fabric of the organization, to the culture that you're developing in a locker room. And those type of things you can't really put a price tag or a statistic on. It's you know, the character type of stuff that keeps guys understanding what a franchise is about and keeps them, you know, dedicated day in and day out to the goal at hand, which is to win championships. Someone has to drive that culture. I know Steph and Clay do it as well, but Draymond's a huge part of that.
So if you're coaching just a league average team, you know, some good players, you know, enough to be a playoff team, how do you negate all the things that Green does? How do you sort of go at him and try to find the weaknesses that allow you to make him at least sort of a zero-sum player as opposed to the guy who changes so much on a night-to-night basis?
It's a really good question. I'm probably not the best person to answer. That's why I'm not an NBA head coach, but I'll give it a shot. What I would do to Draymond, offensively at least, and it's easier said than done. This is all in a vacuum, right? This would be just purely game plan on paper, would be, you know, to try to make him score the ball. Like, I would try to, the best of my ability, cut off any outlets he had to shooters, stay home, you know, double Steph given any opportunity, and then completely deny the ball back to him. Again, much easier said than done. And even the peripheral players there, you know, I wouldn't give those guys the opportunities to catch and shoot off of Draymond's penetration. I challenge him to continue to finish and, you know, see if he could theoretically get 45, you know, 46 or something like that. You know, the Suns, when I play with the Suns, the Mavericks and the Spurs were two teams we struggled with in playoffs. They took that approach to Amari and Steve. They said, look, we know you guys could both wind up with 35, but we trust that if we cut off Sean Marion and if we cut off Raja's 10 to 15 and we cut off Boris's 15 to 17 and we cut off Barbosa's 15, that we'll beat you. And it did. It played itself out over the course of those series. So that's the way I would approach Draymond, at least defensively, because he's so good at facilitating and he's always creating havoc. You know, on the defensive end, you know, I tend to think that, you know, the one way he could be exposed because he plays so many guys so well is with a real true big. And no one really wants to do that. No one has the time to come down and anchor, you know, a big to the block and just, you know, use the mismatch over and over and over. Aesthetically, it's not what people want to see. It's not the way guys are trained to play the game. But that's about all I could really think of because, you know, anywhere on the perimeter, he's pretty good, and pick and roll, he's pretty good. He can guard your man up. But if you had a Joel Embiid type of guy who's just a bully down there on the block and is really well-versed in back-to-the-basket footwork and finishing, that's what I would try to do to him if I had that at my disposal. I'd try to make, you know, that undersized five really pay with a old-school beat-em-up, I can get you 40 on this block type of player, and in the process, I'm going to get you in foul trouble, and now you're on the bench.
Again, I don't know how perfect to defend all positions Draymond would have been in the 80s, but the type of basketball we're playing right now, he is definitely a breed unto himself. Raja Bell, two-time all-defensive member, joining us here on 95.7 The Game. And as a guy, look, we all know that this is a score first, second, and third league. As a guy who was so dedicated to the craft of playing elite-level defense, I'm guessing it was up to you to be the coach on the floor in certain moments and times. How hard is it to be the guy to convince offensive-minded NBA players to do more defensively? Because I'm guessing that was part of your job.
Yeah, it was part of my job. You know, it's difficult. I mean, everyone loves to play offense. It's what you do in pickup games. It's what you grow up doing. And, you know, sometimes, you know, defense is a hard sell to guys. There were teams I played on where I had more success at it than others. Those teams tended to be more successful. But I think when you get on those successful rosters, you know, everyone's thought process is aligned. Typically, people's windows of opportunity are to some degree aligned. And so the sell is easier because, you know, it's an integral part of what you're doing. Every team that's won a championship in the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years that I can remember has been a top 10 team defensively. And, you know, and selling that is just part of what you have to do to be in that conversation. So, you know, you can't be afraid if you're talking about a guy like Draymond or even myself, like to play that role, you can't be afraid of the confrontation. the confrontation is going to be organic when you're that guy. Like, you're going to have guys that don't want to do it, guys that think they're too nice to play, you know, defense and just don't understand how it, you know, important it is to execute that game plan as much as you can. Sure, we're going to make mistakes, but we got to hold each other accountable when we do and try to execute it to the highest percentage we can. And if you're going to be the guy that does that, you know, I was, Draymond is, there are going to be confrontations, but you can't be afraid of it. You got to stick to your guns. And then afterwards, you know, you go find that teammate and whoever it was that may have had a beef, and you explain, look, this, your job is to score 30. Mine is to anchor this and make sure we're on the same page with that. And so I respect you and yours. You know, hopefully you can respect me and mine, because they all come from the same place, which is trying to win some games.
Speaking specifically of Phoenix, this is probably the best defensive team they've had in some years. And because their MO was, well, we'll just score, we'll worry about defense if we have to. Who gets the most credit for changing that mindset? Is it Monty Williams? Is it Chris Paul? Is it something more organic? What made Phoenix view basketball differently this year?
Yeah, I think it's exactly who you said it was. I think, you know, it starts with Monty, and what he preaches in training camp and the mantra that they're going to have through the season, like the culture he's trying to develop. But, you know, sometimes you have to have that guy that everybody respects, that guy that everyone knows his resume, in lockstep with you, preaching and talking the same thing you're talking when you're not around. So on the buses, in the locker rooms, when we're all sitting in the cold tub, you know, when we're out to dinner, you know, the conversation has to reflect what you were talking about as the head coach earlier in the day. So I think the two of them have worked well together. I also throw some credit at my man James Jones, who's doing a great job there in kind of finding pieces. I think the Jay Crowder piece is a really, really good piece to that defensive, gritty type of culture that you're trying to establish with your team. You know, I even think that the Torrey Craig piece was a really nice piece for that. So I think it starts with the two, but you got to give James some credit for finding pieces along the way that help develop that. And then, the young kid from Villanova, I'm drawing a blank on his name right now. I don't know why I hate to do that, but
Bridges.
Mikal Bridges is an excellent defender. Like, they've got nice pieces, but it certainly starts at the top with your best player or your 1A or 1B, and then your coach.
Rajah Bell joining us here. Suns in town taking on the Warriors tonight. What do you think of the play-in, by the way? Are you into it, not into it? Did you think it was a good idea, change your mind and come back to it? How do you feel?
Yeah, I'm cool with it. I've always saw the NBA as the league that wasn't afraid to tinker around the edges and you know, step outside and look at things from a different perspective and see if they could make it more exciting. And so I appreciated it when they put it in. You know, I hear guys beefing about it, but quite frankly, I didn't hear too many people beefing about it when they weren't in that situation the year before, at least the guys I've heard of recently. So for as a fan just sitting back watching now, I'm tuning into games and watching them, and they've got a level of playoff intensity that I enjoy. And, I don't watch every game throughout the season because they don't have that. And I'll tune in now because these games, there's something – on the line, guys are invested, and you can see it. You can feel that intensity if you played and you know how to, like, identify it. Those aren't regular, like, December games. Like, these are heated exchanges with something on the line, and I appreciate it.
Well, so you played. I'm looking at your career here. You played through your age 35 season, and Chris Paul is in his age 35 season right now. How harder was it for you and your body to get up to play an NBA game in your last year? And is Chris Paul like an alien or a freak of nature? How's that happening?
Yeah, well, I got to give him a lot of credit. I mean, at 35, I had certainly lost a step. I could see things and couldn't get to him the way I thought I could. I was losing a little bit of lift on my jump shot, but I think I could have still been serviceable. The end of my career kind of played out in a weird way, but I think these guys do such a great job, like Chris included, in really taking care of their bodies in a way that I didn't really understand when I played, really fueling it the way it needs to be fueled and spending and committing the resources to the recovery and the injury prevention and stuff like that. So,
do you think it's a State Farm insurance and the injury prevention? Is that what it really is?
right. They're just doing great things with the body. And so he's remarkable. What, able to do that at 35 and still be an MVP candidate Like, I mean, you just got to give him all the credit in the world. But generally speaking, you know, these guys, Tom Brady outside the world of basketball, like these guys really know how to dial in and take care of that body and extending careers.
Another guy who's got a lot of miles on him is Russell Westbrook, who has sort of been both much reviled and much praised just in the course of this year. What do you make of him on Washington at this point? Is he jaw-droppingly great? Is he infuriating? Where does he fit?
So for me, and I know he can be polarizing, you know, as a basketball player, I am a Russ fan. As a guy who played with his heart on his sleeve and didn't know any other way to do it, I'll start there. I just appreciate the fact that I know what I'm getting from a competitive level from him every single night. You would think that's something you could count on every night with everybody, but you can't. So that's where it starts. I would then say, as a player who, you know, was a pretty good high school player, averaged, you know, 29 a game, would have 40 and 20 rebound games, I never had a triple-double because it was really hard to fill that third stat with a double-figure, you know, night. And so I never had one in the pros, and I never had one in college. It's really, really hard to do that. And so I think he's fantastic. I understand that analytically speaking, people are going to tell me, hey, their win share is better when he's not on the floor. I would throw back at you, like, the percentage of games that are won when he is actually triple-doubling. I mean, it's super high win percentage. So he plays a certain way. It doesn't necessarily fit the eye test for the way the game is played today. But I can still appreciate it and tell you that it's really remarkable what he's doing if he doesn't shoot threes. Like, he doesn't make threes. I'm okay with that. He's high volume. I play with Allen Iverson. That doesn't bother me. Volume's not an issue for me personally, you know? So I am a Russ fan. I think it's remarkable. I truly believe that you're not going to see anyone break this record. It's just too hard to do. That's why it lasted for as long as it did. And I think people should, to some degree, enjoy what they're watching instead of, you know, bashing the man. And what he's done with Bradley Beal, do you see that roster that they're playing with? No disrespect. I tuned into the game last night. The man had him in a one-point game with Atlanta. Bradley Beal didn't even play. And I looked around. I was like, Ish Smith, Andres Bertans, like, their names. But he's willing them to an opportunity to win. I think his teammates appreciate him. I know his coaches appreciate him. I certainly do. And I think everyone should. Like, stop knocking him. Appreciate it, because it's going to be gone before you know it.
Raja Bell here on 95.7 The Game. You just brought up the fact that you were teammates with Allen Iverson. We just, you know, had the anniversary of his We Talking About Practice soundbite, which obviously we heard so much about. What I didn't know is that he was actually wrestling with the death of a close friend at that time. And I look, knowing that now, I always feel like that soundbite is now being played kind of out of context. Could you take us to that day that still echoes throughout NBA media? And did you realize that, I mean, one of Iverson's all-time memorable moments had just happened? When did you hear about the practice rant? Because you might have been at that practice.
Oh, I was there. I was in the building. I was downstairs in the locker room as Chuck did his you know, press conference or press media availability upstairs. We were at Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine is where we practiced at the time, and we watched it live. And I didn't think much of it. I really didn't. It was just kind of Chuck being Chuck. If you knew him, you know, that's just who he was. And then obviously it's a clip that's lived to some degree in infamy for him for a long time. But, you know, what I also knew about Chuck was it's not a fluke what he did for all those years, having been on the court with him and seeing that he worked. Now, work comes in all shapes and sizes. It comes at all different times of the day. Like, no, maybe he didn't come to practice on time every day, you know? And maybe he wasn't as concerned with the effort in practice as he was in the game. But the point was, he was working on his game at times where people weren't watching it. He was doing the type of things to allow him to be an MVP that year. And that wasn't really appreciated. Plus, like Russell Westbrook, he was the ultimate warrior. I'm 6 foot in Timberlands and 165 pounds soaking wet with two bricks in his pocket. And he was doing that in a day and age where you had multiple seven-footers on the floor for each team. It's remarkable what type of warrior he was. And I think, you know, it's a shame that that soundbite that people want to hold on to, but Chuck is an all-time favorite of mine, again, because he's just a beast.
He's one of my all-time favorites, too. I worshipped at the altar of Georgetown Hoya basketball when I was a kid, so I was a huge fan of Iverson, and I'm glad that you shared all those memories in that story. You were teammates with Steph Curry for one game. One game. Did you realize in the 23 minutes you were out on that court that you were playing with one of the greatest basketball? Of course you didn't. Nobody saw this coming. What was your impression of Curry when you met him, and can you believe what he has become?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I came from Charlotte, and his dad, Dell, was like on the broadcast there. So I watched him at Davidson, and I'd ask Dell about him a lot, you know, and we'd have these conversations. Dell was a good dude. I was into golf. They were clearly into golf. And so I knew him through his dad before I got to Golden State. In that game, like, I had no idea. But I moved out after I had my wrist surgery that year. I went back home after that game, had wrist surgery, and then I came back out to the Bay. And I got to be in practices. I got to be around him. I got to be at the games on the bench. There were things that he did in flashes as a rookie where you knew you were watching something different. Now, as a rookie, he wasn't capturing that like every minute of every game. Like, he hadn't matured into that yet. But I knew that there was something there. I couldn't tell you that he would have revolutionized the game and been what he is today. But you knew that he was better than people even gave him credit for coming out of Davidson, which was, you know, he lit the world on fire at Davidson. But you could see him doing things and making NBA players look silly where you were like, okay, yeah, this is different.
This has been an awesome interview. You've been fantastic. You've shared so much with us. I'm going to push it as far as I can go.
You're good, man. I'm having a good time. What's up?
You're the man who clotheslined Kobe Bryant, for goodness sakes. How would you defend Steph Curry?
How would I defend
him? Would you clothesline Steph Curry?
Yeah, well, listen, I actually tried. I think the first time I played against him, I had signed with Utah. I think I tried to bully him a little bit. I pushed him and shoved him. It didn't work, though. So I had to flip into some other, you know, strategy midstream. I really don't know what you would do with Steph because, you know, unlike some of these guards that are really dancing on the ball so much, I could employ a strategy for that. Steph isn't on the ball that much anymore. Now, he'll cook you if he's on the ball, but, you know, so much of what they do is Steph, you know, seeing if he can get one off and moving the ball, and then a la Reggie and Rip Hamilton and Ray Allen, he's just perpetual motion after that. And so as a defender, you're only really as good as the help you get or the communication on the screen. Like, there was a miscommunication. I stayed with the big didn't stay with Steph, boom, shots in the air. Or he didn't show hard enough shots. So I don't know how you would guard him. It's impossible. All I would say is if they ever brought a secondary defender to Steph Curry and it was organic, I would just trap him. Especially, no disrespect to the team he's on now, but without Clay and KD, I would just have to roll the dice that the other Warriors were going to beat me. And anytime a secondary defender came into the mix, I would trap the hell out of him, make him pass it, and then I'd do my damnedest to kind of deny him the ball back.
Do you like, I mean, it's tough to ask you this because we don't even know who the matchup is going to be, but would you give the Warriors a puncher's chance in any playoff scenario? We're not talking about the play-in. Assuming that they make it in the playoffs, would you give them a puncher's chance against either Utah or Phoenix?
Oh, that's tough. That's tough because I tell you they could win a playoff game because with Steph and what they're doing out there and Draymond, I think, you know, they, in a one-game scenario, it's tough for me over seven. My answer is probably not. I'm not a puncher's chance. I give him a chance because you still have one of the best players on the planet and, to you guys' point, one of the best fives in the game. Seven games is a long series. Four is a lot of games to win. And I just don't know how much real experience they have beyond that. And playoffs require you to have some seasoning. They require you to have been in the wars and kind of learn through trial and error and having your heart broken and figuring it out. And I don't know that there's enough of that surrounding those two. If you made me pick a team that they could have a shot against, it would probably be Phoenix. But I don't really think so. I hate that I have to say that on a Bay Area station.
No. Hey, look, we want you here because you're going to tell us what you really think. That's what makes you a valuable conversation. And I tell you, Logan Murdoch's got a hell of a co-host. This was fantastic. Please promote the podcast. What are you guys cooking up next and when you dropping it?
Yeah, man, we're called the Real Ones Pod. We come out Mondays and Thursdays. We're on the Ringer Network, Spotify. You can get us wherever you get your podcast. But Logan is super cool, man. I've learned a lot working with him, a lot about the Bay Area working with him. And we just have a good time. We're on there. We're not a traditional, like, X and O analytical pod. We just like to talk and have a good time, tell stories, and chop it up. So check us out.
It's a great podcast. I have heard it, and you are great at it. Thank you so much, Raja Bell, for joining us today. This was awesome.
Appreciate it, guys.
Thank you.
And tell Logan we tolerated him.
Fair enough.
There you go. Thank you so much, Raja Bell. That was really, really good. We went long, and I'm glad we did. Really good stuff. How would you defend Steph Curry? We got to get back into that answer and see if he came up with anything that could really actually work. If you go out there and do it, I'll tell you, the way that he and Draymond right now, that is an unbelievable two-man game to watch. They beat Utah last night. What will they look like tonight against the Suns? You can start figuring it all out at 5:30 tonight. Warriors Live, we got J.D. Covey and Jim Barnett getting you ready. Tip-off is at 7 o'clock tonight here on 95.7 The Game. We're brought to you by Fremont Bank, full-service banking, no compromises.